This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Thursday, from bad to worse, the embattled wealth manager AMP sees its full-year profit crash by 97% amidst the fallout from the Financial Services Royal Commission. And a shortage of electric car charging stations holding back the economy. Infrastructure Australia says addressing it is a national priority.
To really take advantage of the benefits that electric vehicles could provide to the economy, you need to have the enabling infrastructure, which is the fast charging stations, in place to really improve people's confidence in their ability to drive the longer distances.
First today to Canberra. Indigenous disadvantage is in an unforgivable state, the Prime Minister has told Parliament this morning as he delivered the annual Closing the Gap report. Scott Morrison said the fact just two of the seven goals are set to be reached reinforces the need for a major overhaul of the targets. He's announced more than $200 million to get teaching graduates into remote area classrooms, while the opposition has repeated its call for an Indigenous advisory body to be enshrined in the Constitution. I spoke to our political reporter, Dan Conifer, a short time ago. Dan, despite the results on the targets, I understand the Prime Minister sees some positives. What are they?
Samantha, that's right. He's pointed to the two of the seven goals that are on track, goals relating to Year 12 attainment as well as child mortality rates. And he's pointed to some other indicators that aren't part of the Closing the Gap framework that are also improving. Smoking amongst Indigenous women who are pregnant has dropped, he told the Parliament, as well as antenatal care. And he's also pointed to one success story for the government. He says that that's in the area of Indigenous procurement, that more government contracts and government funding are going to Indigenous businesses, either fully owned by Indigenous people or owned in large part by Indigenous people, saying that those businesses are more likely to employ Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and therefore will help chip away at the employment target that, again, this year is not on track. So two of the seven are on track. Five of the seven are not, a story that we've heard far too many times since this strategy was announced by Prime Minister Kevin Rudd in 2008. A strategy and approach that Scott Morrison told the Parliament bluntly was set up to fail, emphasising that there is work currently underway behind the scenes to revamp the Closing the Gap strategy to involve state governments more, given it is their schools and their hospitals that are educating kids and treating patients, and that they should shoulder some more of the responsibility, while Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander groups will be more involved with the setting of these targets as opposed to the targets the first time around. It was a sobering assessment that Scott Morrison delivered in the Parliament this morning. Here's some of it.
While I'm not going to pretend today that this situation does not remain in an unforgivable state, I am going to say that we will all never rest as a nation until we change this for all time, all of us, together. And I'm here to say today, though, that there is hope.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, and Dan, the opposition leader, Bill Shorten, has responded in Parliament as well. What did he say needs to change?
He says that Indigenous Australians need to have more of a voice and need to be treated as true partners, that if you are in a partnership with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, that you can't pick and choose the views, values and opinions of those people that you like. And he's repeated his call for an Indigenous voice, as it's been become to be known, to be enshrined in the Constitution, saying that it is his intention for there to be a referendum in the first term of a Labor government, if it is elected later this year, a referendum to be held on whether to include that advisory council in the Constitution. Labor sticking with this policy despite very strong opposition from its early days from the coalition. Labor more on board with the plan that the government has to waive the hex debts of more than 3,000 teaching graduates graduates who go to remote area classrooms and stay there for 4 years or more. Bill Shorten in his speech to Parliament following Scott Morrison welcoming that move. But Linda Burney has one of his front benches and the first Indigenous woman elected to the lower house has reminded people that most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people live in urban areas, and while this will help address the problem to an extent, that you cannot lose focus of Indigenous people living in places like Sydney, Melbourne and Perth. But Bill Shorten, in his speech, says that there is one factor that permeates all of these targets, whether they're on track or mainly off track, and that is racism and Australia's need to tackle that.
If we can't admit that racism still exists, then how on earth do we ever fix it? This is not political correctness, it's just stating the obvious, it's the truth. The truth that Aboriginal people are still suffering from diseases that the rest of us never know, still dying at an age when the rest of us are contemplating retirement.
The opposition leader, Bill Shorten. Indigenous groups are no doubt disappointed at the lack of progress, Dan, but are they optimistic at all?
Optimistic that their voices will be heard a bit more, it seems, as this refresh is underway. We're expecting the new targets to be finalised and unveiled by around the middle of this year. So hopeful that that will mean that there'll be more community buy-in and more progress in reaching these targets. But obviously, after 11 years of the Closing the Gap agenda and year after year of many of the goals being off track, some disappointment. Rod Little is from the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples.
Overall, very disappointing. We've heard similar response last year from the Prime Minister Turnbull. We really want, and we have been pursuing, a better relationship with the government to ensure that these targets, or whatever the targets is, but life expectancy and changes in people's health is expedited.
Rod Little from the Congress of Australia's First Peoples, and before him, our reporter at Parliament House, Dan Conifer. And staying in Canberra, the federal government's been forced on the defensive over its claims rapists and murderers will be allowed into Australia because of the new Medivac laws for refugees and asylum seekers on Manus Island and Nauru. The legislation does give the Home Affairs Minister the discretion to refuse a medical transfer when someone's been convicted of a serious crime. His political reporter, Tom Eagledon.
Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack repeated the claim about the Medivac laws this morning on Sky News.
This is going to be able to get SPIVs and rapists and murderers onto our shores.
Sky anchor Kieran Gilbert immediately challenged the Nationals leader to back up that claim.
They won't be allowed here because the bill says serious crimes would preclude that. That's wrong what you said. What, you admit that?
What Labor says... And what Labor...
What the bill says. I'm sorry, you've got to be factual when you make the case. Do you concede that you were wrong in saying that about...
No, I don't. Because
have you not read the bill?
What? Of course I've read the bill.
Well, you are wrong.
Well, what worries me, what really worries me and what worries a whole lot of people out there is that the bill softens our strong border protections.
The Attorney-General, Christian Porter, also appearing on Sky News, says the legislation applies only to those who've been sentenced for serious crimes.
In instances where someone has been convicted of a serious offence, such as murder or rape, but has not yet been sentenced, and there is very often a separation in time between conviction and sentencing, that person isn't alleged to have committed the offence, they have committed the offence.
Host Kieran Gilbert pressed several times for evidence that such cases exist among those on Manus and Nauru.
You've given me no evidence this morning that there are any individuals in this circumstance.
Well, there is...
Convicted and waiting sentence.
Well, there are many people there who have been charged. There are people who are awaiting trial under sovereign criminal processes of PNG.
How many?
And Nauru. Well, we are trying to ascertain that at the moment.
Opposition leader Bill Shorten's talking up Labor's border protection credentials.
Any government I lead will deploy the full force of the Ring of Steel of the Australian Defence Forces and our border forces.
And talking down the impact of the Medivac legislation Labor supported on Tuesday.
This government has had a system in place where, by and large, if you're sick and the doctors say come to Australia, that is what's happened. The Parliament has codified what the government is doing.
And he says the opposition's not spooked by the ghosts of the 2001 election when John Howard came from behind in the polls to win after the infamous Tampa affair.
I think this country in 2019 is not the same nation as 2001. I do not believe that Australians want a government which governs by slogans and fear.
A different political fight turned physical last night in Parliament. Senior One Nation adviser James Ashby and United Australia Party Senator Brian Burston almost came to blows in the marble foyer after a dinner in the Great Hall. Small business advocate Peter Strong was at the same dinner and witnessed the dust-up.
I saw Senator Burston, he grabbed Mr Ashby, grabbed his phone and threw his phone away. So Mr Ashby, and what I saw, he'd been videoing the Senator. And the Senator walked off with a woman, I understand it's his wife.
The tussle resumed when Mr Ashby retrieved his phone and began filming again.
When Mr Ashby started filming the Senator's wife, then the Senator reacted very quickly. And it became physical, there were no punches, but it was physical. It was also, like, the whole thing was disgraceful. It was disgraceful.
Senate President Scott Ryan is also, it seems, appalled and told the Senate he's investigating.
There are issues that range from the use of media and recording to as claims of assault to potential privilege issues about senators being able to go about their business in the building, just off the top of my head from what I have read in the media.
The Senate President, Scott Ryan, ending that report by political reporter Tom Eagledon. And Senator Burston has now issued a statement saying he acted in self-defence in that incident with Mr Ashby and is accusing him of harassment and making threats over a long period of time. He adds he's approached police to seek a restraining order against Mr Ashby. A Sudanese refugee detained on Manus Island has won a major human rights award in Switzerland. Abdul Aziz Mohammed was given special permission to travel to Geneva to accept the Martin Ennals Award for Human Rights Defenders. The 25-year-old has been outspoken about the quality of life in offshore detention. I spoke to our Papua New Guinea correspondent Natalie Whiting a short time ago. Natalie, what can you tell us about Abdul Aziz Mohammed?
Well, he's a refugee from Sudan. He fled war there as a teenager. And while in a refugee camp, he was concerned about rebels abducting him, and his parents advised him to flee, which he did, and obviously ended up on a boat trying to come to Australia and was one of those taken to Manus Island. So he's been on Manus Island for more than 5 years with the other refugees and asylum seekers there. And he's become a very outspoken person. From very early on, he was one of the main people contacting the media, contacting refugee organisations, human rights organisations, who he's continued working with. In the end, he ended up sending 4,000 voice messages for a popular podcast, and he's sent a lot of vision and done a lot of interviews. So this award, they've said, acknowledging the work he's done in highlighting what was happening on Manus Island, what conditions were like, and for working with those organisations. And he mentioned that and spoke about the work that he has been doing while accepting this award, and also how he and other refugees and asylum seekers are feeling on Manus Island.
Not an easy to be incarcerated in a place where all the fingers pointed at you as a criminal, and all the word that you hear from people surrounding you that you have made a mistake. Why do you come to this country? And you deserve to be in detention center. I took this path to stand up and fight for the rights of everyone on Manus Island. And through my roads, the 5 years that I spent on Manus Island, I have faced so much. I have been harassed. I have been put in a jail from the detention center, solitary confined.
That's Abdul Aziz Mohammed receiving the Martin Ennals Award for Human Rights Defenders in Geneva there. And Natalie, what happens to Mr. Mohammed now?
Well, it's quite incredible that he was able to go to Geneva to accept this award in person. I mean, the award is run by a large group of human rights organisations and the UN, and they've helped assist him in travelling over there because he doesn't have travel documents. So he's over there for 2 weeks. That's been also facilitated by the Swiss government. But he has said that he will be returning to Manus Island. He dedicated the award to people on Manus Island and to other refugees. And he says he wants to go back and take the award back.
And I'm only going to be here for 2 weeks, and I was still going to go back to Manus. And people are waiting for me. People are believing that they are watching very close. They are waiting for me to share this award with them and to let them know that the international community acknowledge our existence, our resilience, our struggle, and most importantly, it's going to be an historical moment for us.
Manus Island detainee Abdul Aziz Mohammed. And before him, we heard from our Papua New Guinea correspondent, Natalie Whiting. This is The World Today. The embattled wealth manager AMP is facing another crisis after its full-year profit crashed by 97% amidst the fallout from the Financial Services Royal Commission. AMP shares have dived as much as 4% after the company's profit tanked to just $28 million compared to $848 million the year before. It's been revealed that almost $4 billion flowed from AMP's wealth management arm last year, with much of it going to the industry superannuation funds left relatively unscathed by the Royal Commission. But AMP's chief executive, Francesco Di Ferrari, was upbeat in the face of the financial and reputational damage when he spoke to the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Francesco Di Ferrari, it must be hard to be upbeat and positive given the challenge you've taken on to rescue AMP.
Well, Peter, you know, I have 5 kids. I am a glass half full kind of guy, so I'm always optimistic.
But you have a 97% fall in net profit, AMP's reputation in tatters, clients heading for the doors, AMP's trust and integrity on life support. How do you turn the AMP ship around?
Yes, we had a very challenged bottom line, but our ongoing businesses actually showed a pretty resilient performance. While the overall result is challenged, actually the ongoing businesses proved very resilient.
Last time we spoke, just after you started as AMP chief executive, you said you like a challenge. That's probably just as well.
Absolutely. I am committed to seeing this through.
But have you had any second thoughts about taking on the job, given the extent of the AMP challenge?
AMP turned 170 last year and plays a critical role in Australian society. But we have to be realistic about the challenges we face so we can tackle them and be optimistic about the future. That view has not changed.
As a result of the Royal Commission reputational impact, you've seen $3.97 billion in net cash outflows from the wealth management business, so clients cashing out and heading elsewhere. Do you expect much of that cash has probably gone to industry superannuation funds?
Well, of the $4 billion, actually $2 billion were pension payments. We have lots of clients who are retiring, and paying them pension is part of our service. And yes, I think we would be in line with industry trends of seeing outflows to industry super funds. We're very committed to be able to reverse that.
Surely that would be no surprise, given that at the moment it must be hard to compete with the industry super's reputation.
Indeed, but we feel we have very competitive product. And one of the issues we're facing now is that a lot of our sales effort today is focused on remediating clients.
How far do you have to go before you've finished that remediation, those payouts for fees for no service?
I mean, AMP is probably one of the companies that is going more forcefully on this. We've announced very sizable provisions, and we've announced that this program will take about 3 years to complete.
What sort of evidence are you seeing that also employers are reviewing or pulling out their corporate superannuation arrangements?
We've actually not lost corporate super fund clients. We've seen a lot of support actually for AMP during a challenging 18.
Given those challenges, what can you do to stem the outflows, and do you expect those cash outflows to continue?
It is a question of time before they revert to normal, so I'm confident that in time we'll be able to reverse the situation.
AMP has $1.6 billion in cash on the balance sheet. Is that enough for now, or will you need to go to the market to get more capital?
We do not intend to raise capital this year.
So that's conclusive. You've got enough on the balance sheet to see your way through, at least for this year.
That is correct.
Just on Kenneth Haynes' recommendations in his final report, what do you see as the biggest impact for AMP, especially in terms of conflicted remuneration?
Well, the Royal Commission report was a confronting but valuable experience, I think, for the industry as a whole, not just for AMP. It's been a huge catalyst for change in our company, probably more than in others. And so we are repositioning the business along those recommendations.
It is early days, but given what we heard in the Royal Commission on fees for no service and lying to ASIC, how likely is it that current or former AMP executives might face court or maybe even go to prison?
Well, we have no new information on that subject. The ASIC investigation has been ongoing for several years, and we are cooperating with the authorities and will diligently work with them.
So you're still relatively happy in the job and prepared to see it through?
I am definitely prepared to see it through so we can get on with building the AMP of the future.
AMP's Chief Executive Francesco Di Ferrari with our Senior Business Correspondent Peter Ryan. In an attempt to boost the number of electric vehicles on our roads, Infrastructure Australia is calling for a countrywide rollout of fast charging sites. In its annual list of priority projects, the statutory authority is recommending the sites be established along the national highway network. The electric car industry says the federal government needs to act quickly if the vehicles are to have a future here. But as the old line goes, if they build it, will they come? Madeline Jenner investigates.
There are quite a few charging stations currently dotted around the Sydney CBD, and I've just come to one. It's in a car park. Obviously, you're meant to leave your vehicle here for a while. But today there's a car in it that's not an electric car. Someone's parked the wrong car in it. And of the couple that the World Today visited this morning, there wasn't an electric car in any of them.
So, here it is, the Nissan Blade Glider.
Nice. Electric?
100%. It goes from 0 to 100 kilometres per hour in less than 5 seconds. As we're in Monaco, we thought we'd have a race.
While the ads are slick, Australians aren't buying them. Electric vehicles make up just 0.2% of Australian cars. The global average is around 2%, and in Norway it's as high as 6.5%. Anna Chow is acting CEO of Infrastructure Australia. She says it's time to put electric cars on the national agenda.
What we identified was that to really take advantage of the benefits that electric vehicles could provide to the economy, you need to have the enabling infrastructure, which is the fast charging stations, in place before you could actually have that adoption.
Infrastructure Australia's announcement is welcome news for the electric car industry. Behad Jafari is CEO of the Electric Vehicle Council.
Well, what we have had for nearly a decade now everywhere else in the developed world are national plans that say this new technology is better for our society. We haven't had that in Australia. We have had federal government ministers say electric vehicles are fantastic, they're going to provide huge economic benefits for us. They just haven't backed that up with any actions.
Under the proposal, fast charging sites would be available along the national highway network for use by truck companies and private drivers. Anna Chow from Infrastructure Australia again.
It really is important now that a proponent be found to actually take up this initiative and to look at the options for implementation. And that may well include private sector participation in the long run in terms of building these fast charging stations.
The key issue is that these fast charging stations are really quick, much faster than the ones people are currently using in their homes. Behad Jafari from the Electric Vehicle Council again.
So when we talk about fast charging infrastructure, which is what the Infrastructure Australia report's about, the latest technology lets a car gain 400 kilometres of charge in 10 minutes, whereas the type of charging that would exist in people's homes or shopping centres in hotels, for instance, would take between 2 to 4 hours to fully recharge a vehicle.
The Electric Vehicle Council says the ball is now in the government's court, because without government support, it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem. Without a charging network, people won't buy the cars, and without the cars, there's less incentive for the private sector to invest in a charging system.
Got an overwhelming amount of interest from the private sector to invest in charging infrastructure. Really what they're looking for is some initial certainty so that they can start investing today. They know that they will invest in this infrastructure at some point, and they're wondering, well, when is that some point for Australia? Because for everyone else it was 8 to 10 years ago. When will Australia be catching up?
Behar Jafari from the Electric Vehicle Council, ending that report by Madeline Jenner. And that's the world today for this Thursday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening at 5 o'clock on RN and on your local ABC station at 6:30. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow with more stories from across Australia and around the world. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.